The Plight of the Uninsured, a laughing matter.
When I was a kid, we didn't have no insurance. You had to be damn near dead to see the doctor. You had to be way past Robitussin. That's all we had when I was a kid, Robitussin. No matter what you got, Robitussin better handle it. Daddy, I got cancer, Robitussin. I broke my leg. Daddy poured Robitussin on it.
Turns out that the Senate Finance Committee may not be offering much more than weak cough syrup for the uninsured in its health care reform plan. The vote is soon. It's expected to pass with no laugh track on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Wednesday, October 7th. I'm John Hockenberry with No Laugh Track here with Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, John. This hour, if you've ever been to a healthcare town hall, you may not have heard people rhyming, but we're going to go to a poetry slam where they're talking about insurance. Also, who's going to get the growing Latino vote? Democrats or Republicans both want it. And it's Wednesday. That means the Takeaway Kitchen is fired up. And today we are talking about pumpkins.
First, let's bring in Dr. Harry Walker, director of the Metro Health Center for Community Health in Cleveland, Ohio. Doctor, do you expect the health care reform package coming out of Washington to be anything more than a placebo for the uninsured?
I hope so. The thing about placebo tends to make you feel good temporarily, but really doesn't do a lot of long-term good. Real health care reform done correctly would actually have a chance to make the country better.
Well, we're going to talk about that real medicine for healthcare reform. Dr. Walker, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment. Right now, everything else you need to know this morning.
In the headlines, 8 years after the beginning of the war in Afghanistan, President Obama meets with his national security team. They're considering a request for more troops. Yesterday, the president told lawmakers he's ruling out a large cut in forces. The Senate faces more voting delays on that healthcare bill we just talked about with Dr. Walker. The Finance Committee is still waiting to hear the final cost estimate of its overhaul plan from the Congressional Budget Office. That could come today.
The Supreme Court hears a case about freedom of religion. Justices will hear arguments today on whether a cross on public land in California violates the First Amendment. Diplomats from across the Western Hemisphere will be in Honduras today to work on the political crisis there. They hope to set up talks between ousted President Manuel Zelaya and the interim leader who took power in a coup. A wildfire burning in Southern California's San Bernardino County is now 75% contained. Thousands of people are able to return to their homes. And two Americans and an Israeli are the latest winners of the Nobel Prize in Chemistry. Their work on cells helped develop antibiotics. Wall Street gained around 1.5% yesterday. The Dow opens at 97.31. The S&P starts trading at 10.55. And the NASDAQ begins at 21.04. And with the Asian markets up as well, the rally is expected to continue. Futures trading points to a positive opening when Wall Street gets underway about an hour and a half from now. So America's fight in Afghanistan has lasted for 8 years. It's a war that, even in the shadow of the Iraq War, shouldn't be forgotten. It certainly hasn't been forgotten by many, many Americans, because many Americans are involved directly in that war, which is why we want to know the story of how the Afghan war has affected your life, in your family, your day-to-day, maybe your coverage of the news. Does it even appear? Maybe it is an invisible war for some of you. We're looking for signs of war in your life. Afghan's war is 8 years on. If it continues into next year, it may become the longest war in U.S. history. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Coming up in just a moment, we're going to talk about who the healthcare overhaul plan is exactly expected to help. But we're also talking about the war in Afghanistan today. It's been 8 years, and we've been hearing your stories.
It was an incredibly rewarding experience. Certainly Afghanistan, the attacks on the World Trade Center and going to Afghanistan is a reason, if there was any reason to get a new uniform, that was it. So the time I spent over there felt very rewarding. It was frustrating at times, particularly as we started to see attention and resources being diverted away from Afghanistan to Iraq. But it is what it is, and you make do with what you have.
That's Captain Adrian Dicker-Kudzinski. She served at Bagram Airfield from late 2002 to early 2003. But what's your story if you went overseas Was it a rewarding experience for you? Do you have a family member, a loved one overseas? And what do you think on the 8th anniversary of the war in Afghanistan? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
Well, Captain Kaczynski there in that response sent to 877-8-MY-TAKE suggests that so much has changed over the 8 years. The reasons for getting involved, the sense of connection to both the troops in Afghanistan and to the nation has changed
and
significantly in the last 8 years. Yes, indeed. And that's part of what we're talking about this morning. But let's move to health care, because in Washington, there's expected to be a vote in the Senate Finance Committee, which has been debating and crafting and amending and de-amending a bill on health care reform. We're going to talk about that for this segment on the program this morning. But first, Dr. Harry Walker, director of the Metro Health Center for Community Health in Cleveland, Ohio. You're watching this debate pretty closely, right?
I'm certainly paying attention, yes.
Now, if they were to pass the bill that the Senate Finance Committee has before it now, who would be outside of the net? Who would remain uninsured? Who would not be touched by this bill as far as you can see?
Well, I mean, right now, it's like I said, there's a lot of devil in the details in this. Depending on how the final vote comes, the concern would be, would there be some folks who would not have enough access to health care?
And do you expect that this would change the situation for the uninsured in any significant way?
Well, there's a chance, if it's not crafted correctly, it would create a situation where it would limit the number of people who would be willing to see folks in these categories. In that case, there could be opportunities where people would have trouble finding a health care provider.
Now, is that population basically the constituency that you serve at the Metro Health Center for Community Health in Cleveland?
It's one of the populations. For instance, everybody talks about undocumented aliens, something like that, but they are around. If they get sick and fall out on the street, somebody has to take care of them. Otherwise, it's a community health problem. So that's a population. Depending, again, on what level of coverage you have, there might be individuals, if they can't find somewhere at other health systems, and they would then come to a place like the Metro Health System seeking health care.
Well, you raise a great point. Dr. Harry Walker, director of the Metro Health Center for Community Health in Cleveland, Ohio. Andre Singleton, sitting here in the studio, 23-year-old, you're a student, right?
Yes.
When you fall, get sick, as Dr. Walker was saying, when you fall down, who takes care of you?
It's a good question. At this point, it's me. It's really problematic for the simple fact I don't have healthcare insurance, especially as a university student.
And you're uninsured now?
Yes.
Right. And do you expect anything from the healthcare bill that you've heard about, read about, that's coming out of the Senate Finance Committee possibly as soon as this week?
I would hope so. I would hope that it would pass, and individuals like myself, and even because I find it extremely problematic too for undocumented aliens that are living and existing within within the U.S., and it's such a touchy subject, and it's something that's so problematic that especially as a university student, trying to find an answer for it on top of like handling academics, which all of these things tie into, leaves me with a lot of like headaches.
Well, you're 23 years old, right?
Correct.
I mean, what medical costs do you have?
I have PET scans, CAT scans, MRIs.
Because
I had cancer.
All right.
Yeah.
So you're a cancer survivor student who's uninsured.
Correct.
All right. So Todd Zwillick, a Takeaway Washington correspondent, we have two data points here in the studio which relate to the bill that the Senate Finance Committee may vote on as soon as this week, but we really don't know. Good morning, Todd.
Hey, John. Good morning.
Now, do these people, here's the director of a Metro Health clinic in Cleveland, Ohio, a 23-year-old uninsured cancer survivor from Kansas City, Missouri, who's in our studio. Did these people fall under this bill that the Senate Finance Committee is considering?
Well, they should, and in some ways they have a choice. The big thing in the Senate Finance Committee bill that you're talking about, John, is called the individual mandate. And what that means is individuals are required to buy health insurance, or if they choose not to, pay a fine. So no one's going to come to Andre's door and shove an insurance policy in his face, and nobody's going to take him to jail if he doesn't buy it.
All right, well, let's talk to Andre about that. So is that a good thing? Nobody's going to force you to buy insurance? You probably don't want to buy insurance. So you don't have the money, right?
Exactly. I mean, I'm a work-study student, so how can I even afford it when I gross $2,000?
So the fact that there's no mandate forcing you to buy insurance is a good thing to you?
I don't know. I mean, it's weird. I mean, because either way it goes, it's a catch-22 because I'm required, because I'll be fine.
Legislatively, Todd Zwillick, explain the catch-22 that Andre is in here.
Well, the catch-22 operates on the individual level for people like Andre, and it operates on the level of the entire government, and it's the tension between affordability and coverage. The point of the individual mandate is to get as many people covered as possible for a lot of reasons. One, a lot of people feel like universal coverage is just the right thing to do in terms of equity. Everybody should have insurance. But also, if you think about insurance and the big insurance pool, it's all about spreading risk. The more people that are covered, the cheaper it is for everyone else. And if you leave people out of that, they're more expensive to cover. But the problem with that is that the more people you cover, the more expensive it is, not only for those individuals if they have to buy coverage, but also for the taxpayer, because we have subsidies and premium support and Medicaid and all of these things. So real quickly, let me have you listen to Jay Rockefeller, sure, senator from West Virginia, on the Finance Committee. He is struggling with this, as all the senators are, and he's frustrated. Listen to Rockefeller.
It affects people, and some people will be disappointed. It doesn't cover everybody, for example. And I think the American people right now are thinking, good, well, this will cover every single person who's uninsured, much less underinsured. And it doesn't do that because we are under this restraint, this fiscal restraint.
So the fiscal restraint is preventing the Finance Committee from covering every single person they want to cover. And in addition to that, because affordability is an issue, you know, telling people like Andre, hey, you don't have to buy insurance, but if you don't, we're going to fine you. They can exempt people from that. Say, all right, Andre, you only make $3,000 a year. We're going to exempt you from this whole deal. You don't have to buy anything. You're exempt. You're out. Great. Well, that saves the bill some money. The problem is that Andre still might get hit by a bus. He still might get sick.
Well, he's a cancer survivor. Yeah, I mean, he's got bills right now.
And he's still going to come to the hospital. And if he doesn't have coverage, the hospital hopefully won't turn him away. Dr. Walker won't turn him away. The taxpayer still has to pay for it. And that's the tension everyone's dealing with.
So Dr. Walker, one of the ways that they've gotten around including a public option in this bill is by offering tax credits to people. And, you know, I'm sure that for those on the very low end of the income scale, that a tax credit can't help. And I'm wondering about your patients, that for the people that you see, how many of them are paying enough taxes that the tax credit for their health plan would make a difference?
I doubt if that's a significant group, particularly for the low end, the working poor, as you call them. They're not paying that many taxes to begin with. And see, the catch-22 for the public institutions like ours is that you look at many aspects of that bill that over time they actually cut how much support they provide to safety net hospitals, with the idea that we won't need the funds. But as you already are talking about, there's going to be a group of people who still aren't covered and who's still going to show up at our doorstep and need health care. And somebody has to pay for it some kind of way.
Well, Dr. Walker, then what about the subsidies? If people get direct cash payments for services at your clinic, does that help you out? Does that make your safety net stronger?
If the people if they're provided by, like, county or government authorities.
John, let me jump in there just real quick, because this bill, for people who are the working poor, and it's a sliding scale on a complicated table, but a lot of people would get direct subsidies from the government to pay for their insurance and to pay some of the extra costs like co-pays and things like that. So if you truly are working poor, this bill tries to give direct money to those people so that they can get coverage.
Well, let's do some math with Andre. Would you consider yourself one of the working poor, Andre?
Definitely.
All right. So how much could you typically afford if the government was kicking in something of a subsidy? And Todd, listen to this, because I want you to know, I want to see if the math jives with who they're trying to target this bill towards.
And exactly. Even as I listen to the conversation, it's something that, like, if I'm a work study student, on top of having to buy books, on top of having to pay rent, I literally have like no money to pay for the basics as far as food. So there's something that's going to have to be sacrificed anyway. You know, so it's
so $1,000 a month you couldn't do.
Definitely.
$500
not.
A month.
No.
$200
I mean, it would have to be literally something like 25, and that's pushing it.
Andre Singleton, 23-year-old student and uninsured cancer survivor from Kansas City, Missouri. Todd, to take us out in the last 30 seconds, does that math work for this bill, and is he going to fall outside the safety net?
Well, if Andre is truly living on really no cash flow, like at or below the poverty line, he would probably actually do okay in this bill. He would probably get full subsidies and may get his insurance for close to free.
Well, that's good news. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. We also spoke with Dr. Harry Walker, director of the Metro Health Center for Community Health, the Safety Net in Cleveland, Ohio. Dr. Walker, thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, you want that to go?
That's right, some takeouts on stories we want you to stay on top of this week. And, of course, we've been following health care, speaking about who's covered and who's not in the Senate bill there with Todd Zwillick at the top of the hour. But we decided to send Femi Oke on a takeout investigation to find voices other than the ones you see in the cable news boxes or the town meetings,
screaming,
all the news
yelling.
Footage. So what'd you find?
I went to a very diverse area of Brooklyn, and I went to the basement of a bar in Brooklyn. And it's a very mixed area, very mixed racially, very mixed in terms of income as well. And in that basement were 150 people crammed together. What was unusual, we didn't see in the town halls from earlier on this summer, all young people between the ages of 18, 19 and 30 years old.
Talking about healthcare?
They're talking about healthcare reform and in a specific style. They were doing it in slam poetry or spoken word style. So we're basically talking poetry addressing the healthcare debate. You may be thinking, how on earth do you do that? So let me introduce you to Jafrasi Peralta. She's 19 years old, and she went up to the open mic.
You just lost your job, so you no longer have a budget for health, so yours plummets. Add pills on top of bills on top of pills, and it kills us. See, in America, healthcare is more of like a business, and the youth got the shorter end of the stick. Just old enough, so my insurance company split, and now I have to reapply, and God forbid that I get sick within that time, because all of my grandmother's home remedies just slip my mind.
Who is she speaking to there?
She's speaking to other people in the audience, young people like herself, and also talking about her experience. Now, Jafrasi's grandfather got very sick. Unfortunately, he died earlier on this year. He went to the Dominican Republic to get healthcare treatment because he couldn't afford to get it done here in the United States. So a lot of people there who wanted couldn't afford it. So it's their stories that illustrated perhaps why we need healthcare, why they need healthcare reform.
Who else did you meet?
I also spoke to James. He's 19 years old. He's a slam poet. And he talked about his community and the area that he lives in and why people are so sick there.
North America raised me in the hood where AIDS lives in neglected bone marrow buildings, where nervous citizens ride and walk around strapped with KFC snackers. Who needs drive-by shootings when we have diabetes?
Well, he's identifying something that the Obama administration is very focused on, obesity, childhood diabetes, serious problems in urban areas all over the United States.
And also in this town hall, there were flyers. It was very political. An organization called Generation H actually organized it, a healthcare organization who were trying to make people more educated. So there were lots of information, people could get information. But it was the poetry, the way that the debate was actually dispersed in that basement in Brooklyn that made people really, really upset. People were crying. They were talking about their personal circumstances. One woman had two surgeries. She's 20 years old. Her name is Nina Skay, and she owes $100,000. And she said to me, Femi, I'm never going to own a house. I'm just going to pay off my surgeries for the rest of my life.
Holy cow.
When I came back, I was so moved. I spoke to Todd Zwillick, who's our Washington correspondent. And I said, well, Todd, why are these people doing this, because who's going to listen to them? And he said to me, it's not too late. Actually, now is a really good time to talk to your representatives. You can actually call the Capitol Hill switchboard and actually talk to your representatives, because now is when they're making
poetry slam the Capitol.
Yeah, absolutely.
There you go.
Let me leave you with one more voice. This is Dina. She's 24 years old. She'd love to have healthcare, but she can't afford it. She works in the hotel industry. And when she started to sing, the whole audience got goosebumps.
If I was a rich girl, la 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 la, said I'd have all the money in the world if I was a wealthy girl.
Town meeting, voices from a basement in Brooklyn, Fort Greene, Brooklyn, part of the healthcare debate, a takeout from our own Femi. Okay, thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
Now to Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, takeaway sports contributor. A very exciting finish to the baseball game last night.
And a pitch bounce right side, base hit. Here comes Gomez around third. There'll be no play. The Twins have won the Central.
Well,
It's
okay. I'm okay with
doing?
It, John. I'm fine. Right. I'm okay with it. But, you know, I mean, if the Tigers were going to leave the baseball play, what an amazing game.
It was an amazing game.
The Tigers are the first team that were up three games with four to play
to lose a division
series. We didn't actually have to bring up that statistic.
And Carlos Gomez, who actually is from the Mets organization, who came from the Mets, Carlos Gomez was brought in for speed. And if you saw that play, when that ball got hit, when Casilla hit that ball, he was speeding around those bases. If he had not been there and if they had not focused on speed, they literally would not have scored that point. And it was an amazing, incredible game. And incredible for the Metrodome, who was there both games last night with the Monday Night Football game and the night before with the Monday Night Football game and last night. That person must be out of their mind right now.
So the Twins beat the Tigers 6-5, 12 innings in that game. Who are they going to go on to play in the division series?
Well, they're going to play the best team in baseball, the New York Yankees.
And they're playing it exhausted.
They're playing exhausted, but this is interesting. The wild card since 1995 has been in effect for non-first place teams with the next best record to go against division leaders to get into the playoff hunt. So in that time, four World Series champions have won the wild card. And I mention the wild card not because the Minnesota Twins are the wild card, but they're playing like the wild card. They have the momentum of the wild card going in. So they might be playing exhausted, but they have the energy. And I think the Yankees should be a little worried.
And they're facing the Yankee ace, CC Sabathia, today. And if he doesn't have a good game, the Twins could really have some big mo.
And that's interesting about both parks, the Yankee Stadium and Metrodome, both the ball flies out of the park. So this actually could be an offensive attack from both sides. And Joe Mauer, who's the catcher for the Twins, he is the MVP.
Okay, we also see the Rockies play the Phillies and the Cardinals play the Dodgers tonight. Thanks so much to Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen.
Hey, good morning.
Contributor.
Of course, you can't hit a ball out of the Metrodome. It's got a roof on it, you goofy guy. Our last takeout comes from you, our listeners. All week we've been talking about the war in Afghanistan, 8 years since it first began, 8 years today. We're hearing your stories.
My name is Zach Barnes from New Hampshire. I served in the United States Army for 4 years, and then I served in Afghanistan from January 2006 to January 2007. People say it's getting worse. I think our situation is getting slightly better. People are starting to focus more on what in the past has been called the Forgotten War. And when we were there in 06, we really felt almost like we were forgotten. Everything everyone ever heard in the news was about Iraq.
You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We got the story of one person who really changed his life because of the Afghan War.
My name is Cliff Russell. I entertained troops in 2004 at several different Middle Eastern locations on behalf of my brother's death as a firefighter in 911.
We're going to continue talking about the war in Afghanistan all week. Today is the 8-year anniversary, and we're wondering, what is your story? Have you changed your life because of the Afghan War? Have you served? Has someone in your life served? And what are your ideas about what's happened? Have they changed since the war began all the way up until the 8-year mark today? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. John, I think probably the 8-year anniversary has snuck up on some people.
I think so.
Coming up, New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez talks about ignorance and bigotry in the healthcare debate. That's just in a moment, but first some news stories that we're following at 32 minutes after the hour. 8 years ago, the U.S. war in Afghanistan began. Today, the president has new talks with his national security team about a potential new strategy in Afghanistan. Yesterday, he told lawmakers he will not substantially cut troop numbers now. Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid was in those bipartisan talks.
Everyone, Democrats and Republicans, said, whatever decision you make, we'll support it, basically. So we'll see.
The top U.S. commander in Afghanistan is asking for as many as 40,000 more troops there.
Staying in Washington, the Supreme Court takes up a First Amendment religion case today. They'll hear arguments about an 8-foot cross at a World War I memorial. It's on public land in a California park. Out in space, scientists have discovered another ring around the planet Saturn. It's the biggest one yet, and it may explain why one of Saturn's moons has a dark side. The White House will have some stargazers of its own tonight. The president has invited students to the White House lawn. They'll look into space with help from astronomers. And two Americans and an Israeli are the latest winners of the Nobel Prize in chemistry. Their work on cells helped to improve antibiotic drugs. Democratic senators are taking on a Supreme Court ruling, making it harder to prove workplace age discrimination. Senators have hearings today on the issue, and a bill is in the works. And from the stars above to the stars on the stage, former Congressman Tom DeLay won't be on Dancing with the Stars anymore. He doesn't want to spend more time with his family. No, the Hammer has injuries on both feet. He says he's pulling out on doctor's orders.
You can't practice. And if you can't practice, you make a fool out of yourself out of here. And I don't want to do that to Cheryl.
That would be Cheryl Burke, his professional dance partner. I wonder if his insurance, medical insurance there, is paid for by a public option.
He has great insurance.
It is. So, so those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Senator Robert Menendez has a new book out. It's called Growing American Roots, Why Our Nation Will Thrive as Our Largest Minority Flourishes. And the minority he's talking about is Latinos. Menendez argues that Democrats should reach out more to Latinos because they're a secret weapon as a voter population. He joins us from Washington. Thanks for joining us, Senator. And let's start with health care, because there's a rancorous debate going on about whether or not the plan is going to cover illegal immigrants. You make a point in your book that many illegals pay taxes for which they don't see the benefits. But you also point out that people seem to be unfairly connecting the Latino American community to illegal immigrants.
Well, there's a broad brush being painted here. And, you know, one of the things I try to do in our book is to talk about the community in our country, the Latino community in America, and establish the fact that we have been here since before the country was founded. And we have actually fought for the country from its birth. When Bernardo de Galvez, the governor of Louisiana, actually helped stop the British advance on Washington, where Cuban women had their gold mantled at Valley Forge to help Washington in the desperate times, when, Admiral David Farragut, Farragut Square here in Washington is named after him, was the first admiral of the Navy fighting on behalf of the Union. To the Korean War, where you had the 65th Infantry Division, an all-Puerto Rican division, one of the most highly decorated in the country, and the list goes on and on. So we have been here since before the founding of the country. And so these suggestions that, number one, we are recent arrivals, number two, that even those who are undocumented in the country get cast in a negative light when overwhelmingly they are seeking to pursue the American dream, and where Americans of Hispanic descent often get caught up in immigration raids as U.S. citizens and legal permanent residents is simply unacceptable. And so we try to create a little bit of the history in this book to set the record straight in terms of how much we've contributed to the country, how we have been here since before the founding of the country, and how we continue to offer opportunities for prosperity for the country.
You know, your daughter wrote in a quote, the GOP doesn't care about Latino voters. And I'm wondering if you agree with your daughter.
Well, I mean, they can't possibly have a real commitment to Latino voters when you look at the policies of the last 8 years of the Bush administration, when they have policies that strike at the very heart of the progress of the Latino community. You can't come courting them at election time, but through 8 years of Republican policies hurt them.
Well, let me ask you a question about health care, since the Senate Finance Committee is going to vote this week on finally the Max Baucus bill. You voted, if I'm correct, against the amendment that would have actually reduced the cost paid to pharmaceutical companies for individuals who qualify for both Medicaid and Medicare, a savings of something on the order of $108 billion, right?
I did, and the reason I did is because, number one, is the pharmaceutical industry is already anting up $80 billion here. We're closing the donut hole by half. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that President Obama struck a bargain with a series of entities in the healthcare industries who are anting up. And my concern is that we undermine the whole nature of that agreement and have zero towards the donut hole.
Except one could also make the argument that the reason you voted against it is because Baxter, Abbott, ImClone, Merck, Becton Dickinson, and Johnson & Johnson are all headquartered in your state of New Jersey.
Well, look, you know, I could say that about any senator across the country on any given issue. There are industries unique to a state. That doesn't mean that that's the only driving issue. The reality is,
so you represent
is that
them?
Like other is that other entities throughout the healthcare system are contributing towards the overall payment of healthcare insurance, and at the same time, we want to make sure that we can move forward. If you get that coalition that comes apart, then you won't get the type of healthcare reform we all want.
We spoke with somebody from the Equity for All organization, which is representing African-Americans and Latinos in the healthcare debate. And Dr. Smitherman said that he can't imagine how to better serve minority communities than through the public option. So I'm wondering, do you support a public option in healthcare?
I do. And I was one of the strong voices in the Finance Committee for a public option. I supported both provisions, Senator Rockefeller's and then Senator Schumer's, that just fell two votes short of having it pass. I am an advocate that it be included in the melded bill that will take place on the Senate floor. And if not, I will join others in pursuing an amendment. And I think we still have a good road here with a good opportunity to have a public option in the final bill, which I think is eminently important because it ultimately is a real competition controlling costs and a nonprofit, self-sustaining, premium-driven public option, I think, is going to make all the difference in the world in terms of controlling health care costs and giving people real choice.
Okay, Senator Menendez, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Senator Robert Menendez is a Democrat from New Jersey, author of Growing American Roots, Why Our Nation Will Thrive as Our Largest Minority Flourishes. All this week, we're talking about Afghanistan, and we're trying to find out how the war has affected you and what do you think about it 8 years on.
This is Mary from Mount Clemens, and I'm ashamed to admit that I really don't even think much about the war except every Sunday our church prays for those who are serving. And other than that, a whole week goes by, and unless I hear it on NPR, I'm not thinking about it, and I'm not proud of that fact.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org with your take on Afghanistan. Coming up, we're going to talk about pumpkins. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. 8 years ago today, the first bombs began to fall and U.S. troops began to arrive in Afghanistan.
On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against Al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan.
It was the first response by a nation reeling in pain from the attacks on September 11th, 2001, attacks that conferred a particular national outrage on the people of America, a particular sense that justice would now be done.
83% of Americans believe that the United States should take forceful military action against the people responsible for these attacks, even if it means risking further retaliation and the threat of war. 66% say the attacks are more serious than the bombing of Pearl Harbor.
We believed the entire world would recognize America's pain and join the fight, and for a time it seemed as though that was true. Here's Secretary of State Colin Powell.
And we're asking all the nations to join together to use political action, diplomatic action, economic action, legal action, law enforcement action, and if necessary, join with us as appropriate, and if necessary, in military action when we have identified the perpetrators and decided what military action might be appropriate.
And they decided Afghanistan. Afghanistan, remote, obscure. There was that Soviet invasion, some business with the Brits, a hazy Gunga Din history of the brave and the raw warlords and palaces. But perhaps the war in Afghanistan began for the U.S. very quietly even before the bombs began to fall, even before September 11th, with the almost invisible death of one very obscure man. That's Tajik warlord Ahmed Shah Massoud from northern Afghanistan. He'd been warning the United States of the growth of al-Qaeda in his country, and in one of his last interviews he spoke about Osama bin Laden himself, a name then unknown to most Americans. Massoud pleaded with journalists to deliver his message, and on September 9, 2001, Massoud was killed by al-Qaeda operatives posing as journalists. It was the green light for September 11th and all that followed.
Tom, the first indications we knew that an attack was underway was the sparkle of AAA anti-aircraft artillery fire over the skies just above the city of Kabul, followed by the orange blossom of explosions. Now, we couldn't hear it from
I remember where I was exactly when the bombs began to fall over Kabul. I ran to the top of a hill in Massachusetts on a sunny Sunday late afternoon, not a cloud in the sky. Ran into two neighbors who rolled down their car window and shook their heads, Bev and Harry, in their 80s. They looked worried. Hope someone knows where we're going with this war business, Harry said. We could be over there for some time. Harry didn't live to see the war's 8th birthday. I still see Bev, in her 90s now, on that same hill, still shaking her head about this war business 8 years later, and all the promises that have yet to come true.
The fact is, in this battle against terrorism, there is no silver bullet. There is no single thing that is going to suddenly make it that threat disappear.
Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense, a man wrong about so much, said that 8 years ago today. More than 800 dead American soldiers ago, more than 18,000 Afghans killed.
To all the men and women in our military, every sailor, every soldier, every airman, every Coast Guardsman, every Marine, I say this, your mission is defined, your objectives are clear, Your goal is just. You have my full confidence, and you will have every tool you need to carry out your duty.
It's not the largest war in American history, far from being the bloodiest, but sometime next year, it may become the longest war in American history. It started 8 years ago today.
I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. We're going to be talking about food as we do every single Wednesday, and today we will be talking about pumpkins, the great squash. More on that in just a moment. We're also talking about Afghanistan today. It has been exactly 8 years since the war began, but are you seeing it in your life?
Good morning. Troy calling from Dakota. This is not an invisible war to me because I occasionally see a 20-year-old amputee veteran walking the streets of my hometown, and I don't believe for a second that what we're doing over there is worth that sacrifice. Bring them all home. We need to be better students of history and ask ourselves, why do they call Afghanistan the graveyard of empires?
America's war and your stories of how it looks in your life or not. 877-8-MY-TAKE. In the headlines, President Obama meets with his national security team today to consider a request for more troops. Here's White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs on the deliberations.
The president's going to make a decision, popular or unpopular, based on what he thinks is in the best interest of the country.
President told lawmakers in a meeting yesterday that he's ruling out a large cut in forces. Today's meeting is the latest in a series of meetings on strategy in Afghanistan and Pakistan. The Senate has passed a defense spending bill barring Guantanamo detainees from transfer to America. Attorney General Eric Holder says he's concerned about the measure. He wants those prisoners tried in the U.S.
A wildfire burning in Southern California's San Bernardino County is now 75% contained. Thousands of people are able to return to their homes. Good weather is helping firefighters beat those flames. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton wants Guinea's military leader to give up power. Dozens of pro-democracy protesters in the West African nation died last week in clashes with soldiers. Out in space, scientists have discovered another ring around the planet Saturn. It's the biggest one yet, and it may explain why one of Saturn's moons has a dark side. The White House will have some stargazers of its own tonight. The president has invited students to the White House lawn. They'll look into space with help from astronomers. And those are some of the news stories we're watching this morning. All you can eat. Well, I'ma stuff my face to a funky beat. We're gonna walk inside. And guess what's up?
Put the food on my plate. Add some coke in my cup. Well, we talk about food every Wednesday on The Takeaway, and it is October. That means many of us are going to start seeing pumpkins appearing outside our grocery stores. Very often, those pumpkins are going to be made into pies or even more often carved into jack-o'-lanterns for Halloween. But there's lots of other things you can do with pumpkins. Joining us is Lola's Eric Eli, food writer and author of Smokestack Lightning, Adventures in the Heart of Barbecue Country. So pumpkin pie made from canned pumpkin, I understand, was banned in your home when you were growing up.
Well, we were very religious in that regard. Fresh pumpkin was always on the agenda for us. And also one particular kind of pumpkin that doesn't look like the rest of them. It's called the Kushaw, which is like a crook-necked striped pumpkin. That was always our favorite.
Some people use that as a decoration in their home. Sometimes we see it glazed over so they can put it on their hearths in the fall. But you used it in recipes. Is it a different taste than the standard orange pumpkin?
A slightly different taste. You know, with pumpkin, you end up putting so much sugar and pie seasoning, that kind of thing, till those differences become as much about what you put in it as it is about the exact flesh of the pumpkin. So the taste was subtly different.
So we're also joined by Michael Crandall, food writer and author of The Great Little Pumpkin Cookbook. So, you know, it's so standard often in America for people to cook with canned pumpkins that you even see recipes where they tell you how many cans of pumpkin to use. Why don't we cook with real pumpkins?
Well, I think a couple of reasons. I actually think canned pumpkins aren't bad. I'm not one of these people who thinks...
You can't ruin a pumpkin is sort of the deal.
Well, you can't ruin a can of pumpkin. Right, right.
That's because it comes pre-ruined.
Well, maybe. But the thing about cooking a real pumpkin is that, in part, we're lazy.
Yeah, there is that.
So that we want to open up a can and have it all ready to go. The other thing is that, you know, you get this big pumpkin. It's a jack-o'-lantern pumpkin mostly. And the problem with jack-o'-lantern pumpkins is they're actually lousy for cooking. So that people usually have had this bad experience. They buy the pumpkin. They carve it. They have it half rot. And then they start cooking it. And that's not how you make pumpkin pie.
Is it basically the deal here that you remove the butternut squash from the recipe and insert pumpkin, that they're interchangeable? Or is there something fundamentally different and new about the pumpkin in your view, Michael?
Well, there's nothing new about a pumpkin, obviously, right? But what you have is you have a whole bunch of different varieties of squashes. One of those varieties of squash is the pumpkin.
Right.
The problem is that the pumpkin, the jack-o'-lantern pumpkin, is lousy for pie.
Yeah, you have to get these the little ones. They call them pie pumpkins.
Yeah, pie pumpkins, Jack B. Little pumpkins, little guys. Or you buy something called a cheese pumpkin, which is my favorite for cooking pumpkin any old way.
What's a cheese pumpkin?
A cheese pumpkin is apparently called a cheese pumpkin because it kind of looks like a Gouda cheese. It's this big round thing that looks like a pumpkin.
Kind of flat.
But it's sort of flat, kind of tan. And it turns out that, you know the Cinderella story?
Yes.
Well, Cinderella, French story. Pumpkins are very popular in the south of France and other parts of France for cooking, for making into soup, for making into tarts, for making into a gratin. Well, if you look at those original illustrations of the pumpkin from the Cinderella story,
well, that's into actually the coach. That turns into a coach.
Right. That's actually a cheese pumpkin.
Oh, okay. Well, it seems like she must have been rather short then, because I think of them as being kind of, you know.
Well, I'm talking about like old French illustrations, not Disney.
Okay.
Pre-Disney.
So, Lois, we've actually have a little bit of a pumpkin shortage. The pumpkin crop was short last year. So what kind of things can people do if they don't see pumpkins, if they don't see even canned pumpkins in their grocery store? What other things can we do if they want to do something different?
Well, if we look at the other kinds of pumpkins, if you look at the non-jack-o'-lantern pumpkins like the Kershaw, you got possibilities there of either pie or what we call a pone, which is in essence a crustless pie. So you do the same kind of ingredients you might with sugar, butter, eggs, and just bake it without a shell. There's one easy way to do it.
Are they interchangeable? Are all of these different pumpkins that you're talking about interchangeable?
Yeah, they are actually. They really are. I mean, the drag about pumpkin is that no matter which one you do, unless you do the can thing, which actually can work, you end up having to do two steps. You cut it up and boil it, get the meat out, and then cook it the way you want to cook it. But once you get to that step, all of them can be done basically the same recipes.
So, Michael, one of the things you talk about in The Great Little Pumpkin is how much Europeans use pumpkins, actually more than Americans do in their cooking anyway. And I'm wondering, can we use the same? Do we find the same pumpkins here as you're finding from these recipes that come from Europe?
Yeah, you do. In fact, that cheese pumpkin is more or less the same thing. And just to throw in more confusion into the mix,
yes,
the Kershaw, which I always think somebody should say, you know, Gesundheit the minute they say it, Kershaw. The Kershaw, there's actually two different kinds that are totally unrelated, and the one that Lois is talking about looks like a big sort of crooked club. There is another one that is, in fact, also called a Kershaw, which looks like a big round cheese pumpkin. And that's, in fact, what Libby's uses for their pumpkin puree.
Interesting.
But to get back to your question, what was your question?
I was just wondering.
They're available, though.
Yeah, you can get
them. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Farmers markets have them, and fancy food stores seems like they have them these days, too.
Michael Crandall, food writer and author of The Great Little Pumpkin Cookbook, also Lola's Eric Eli, takeaway contributor and author of Smokestack Lightning, Adventures in the Heart of Barbecue Country.
And we'll have recipes for Michael Crandall's recipe for roasted pumpkin stuffed with bread and Gruyere cheese and more on our website at takeaway.org. Share your own recipes, too, by the way.
Hi, this is Heather from Massachusetts. A substitute for pumpkin in pies is sweet potato. We don't really do that too much here in New England, but Southerners do it, and it's delicious. I actually think it's better than pumpkin pie because it's slightly sweeter, but you can use the exact same recipe and substitute baked sweet potatoes for the pumpkin.
While you're there, you can hear performances from that healthcare poetry slam of Femi Okeh a little bit earlier this morning.
In America, healthcare is more of like a business, and the youth got the shorter end of the stick.
All the performances at thetakeaway.org, but Tom emails us at mytakeatthetakeaway.org. Slam poetry, John, really? What year is this? 1992? Ugh, fail. All right. But there is a lot of stuff that got people talking today. Celeste, we talked earlier with Senator Robert Menendez, who defended the importance of Latinos in America.
The point is not whether given ethnic groups who are already here legally are virtuous and have contributed many things to the country in the past. The point is whether the country can continue to accept new waves of immigrants of whatever ethnic group simply because of the numbers that the land can support.
We're talking with you about the Afghanistan war on the 8th anniversary of the war, and we want to know how it's affected your life.
My name is Karen Dallas-Andre, and the only way the Afghan war has affected me is I stopped watching 60 Minutes because all they want to talk about is the war, and I don't want to hear about the war anymore. I don't feel like it's my war.
Hi, this is John from New Jersey. My son John Jr. is in the U.S. Army and has already served two tours over in Afghanistan. When I asked him his take on a Afghani problem, he kind of laughs and says, from what he's seen out in the field, you're dealing more with 15th century warlords rather than the central government. And he said the U.S. will do nothing there until they realize this and start dealing with local issues rather than international politics.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry. We love to hear from you. This is The Takeaway.
It's been 8 years since the U.S. declared a war on terror and began dropping bombs on Afghanistan. For some, the reasons for fighting remain clear.
Certainly Afghanistan, the attacks on the World Trade Center and going to Afghanistan is the reason. If there was any reason to get a new uniform, that was it.
But for some enlistees, the realities of war are overwhelming.
I had never seen war, and to actually see what war is after an airstrike, or after a woman runs up with a child who picked up a cluster bomb and you're trying to stick an IV in her neck, it was mortifying to me, and it was absolutely horrible, and it stuck with me to this day.
The war sticks with us 8 years on, and we remember on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, October 7th. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry.
Good morning, Celeste. This hour, we'll cover the war in Afghanistan from Kabul to Bagram to Washington. We'll go to Afghanistan for a look inside Taliban-controlled shadow governments. And we'll look at what President Obama might do next in the war.
But first, Sergeant Joe Sturm joins us. He's a staff sergeant in the Army and a veteran of the first Gulf War and the war in Afghanistan. Sergeant Sturm, do you still think this is a war of necessity?
I think the war in Afghanistan is a necessity insofar as it's not in the world's best interest to see Afghanistan remain as a failed state. I think the work that Americans are doing there with regard to political reconciliation and helping the Afghan population is absolutely necessary.
Sergeant Joe Sturm, stay with us. We're going to be back with you in just a moment. Right now, though, everything else you need to know this morning.
Well, in the headlines, Celeste, today, President Obama meets with his national security team to discuss strategy in that war. Sergeant Sturm and others have been fighting. The White House is considering a request for more troops in Afghanistan. The president told lawmakers yesterday that he's not looking at a large reduction in forces. The Senate Finance Committee faces more voting delays on its health care reform bill. Members are still waiting on a new number crunch of the cost of the overhaul plan from the Congressional Budget Office.
The Supreme Court hears a case about freedom of religion today. Justices will hear arguments on whether a cross on public land in California violates the First Amendment. And in Honduras, diplomats are gathering in an attempt to set up talks between ousted President Manuel Zelaya and the interim leader who took power in a coup. A wildfire burning in Southern California's San Bernardino County is now 75% contained. Thousands of people now are able to return to their homes. Wall Street gained about 1.5% yesterday. The Dow opens at 97.31. The S&P starts trading at 10.55 and the NASDAQ starts at 21.04. That's with Asian markets up today as well. Major indices closed up more than 1% there.
The futures trading suggests, though, the Dow is going to be lower when it opens in about a half hour from now.
Huh. America's fight in Afghanistan has lasted for 8 years. It's a war that even in the shadow of the Iraq War should not be forgotten. So we want to know how it looks in your family. Do you have someone serving overseas? Have you served? And what do you think about the war 8 years long? Have your thoughts about the war in Afghanistan changed since it began 8 years ago today? Let us know. We're looking for the signs of war in your life. We'll be right back.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. On October 7, 2001, the United States military went to war in Afghanistan. Across the country, stirred by feelings of outrage and patriotism, thousands of Americans enlisted, like former police officer Steve Husong.
I felt at that time, because it was the beginning of the war, that we had actually taken down the country and ended the entire war, later to find out that we didn't.
8 years later, 68,000 American troops are still fighting in Afghanistan. 869 of them have been killed. Today on The Takeaway, we mark the 8th anniversary of the start of Operation Enduring Freedom. We're going to be talking about the anniversary of the war in Afghanistan throughout the hour. And it's only right that we start with people who sacrificed the most, the veterans. We have with us Joe Sturm, Staff Sergeant in the U.S. Army, veteran of the first Gulf War and the current war in Afghanistan. Also joining us, Staff Sergeant Genevieve Chase, stationed first in Helmand and then at Bagram. And also a Marco Reininger. He's with the AAVA, that's the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of American spokesperson, specialist in the National Guard and a veteran of the war in Afghanistan. Good morning to you all. Let's start with why all of you decided to join the military and enlisted. Joe, why did you end up enlisting? Because you re-enlisted after you'd left the military, correct?
That's correct. I joined the Army when I was 18 and straight out of high school. For the usual reasons, I was patriotic when I was very young. I mean, I still am, and I served for about 14 years and got out and then signed back up in 2003. I think with the knowledge that I would be deployed somewhere, Iraq or Afghanistan, and sure enough, it happened.
And Genevieve, you're a veteran of Afghanistan. Why did you decide to go? And why did you want to serve in Afghanistan?
I didn't agree necessarily with all the reasons that we went into Iraq. I wasn't particularly following that particular war at the time, but I followed a little bit what was going on in Afghanistan. And being a granddaughter of a Korean woman who survived the Korean War and of having that in my family, I felt like I needed to somehow pay back to my country and to the people who served during that time by ensuring the same benefits and liberties for other people in other places. And I was particularly concerned with the women and children in Afghanistan.
You know, this issue that you raised, Genevieve, of payback as an idea of service is sometimes at odds or even in some tension with another notion of payback, which I think was more common right after September 11th. Marco Reininger, did you join up or go to Afghanistan with a sense of either payback to your country as a form of service or payback against the people who might have done America harm?
Well, John, it was basically both. Being from New York or being in New York at the time, I definitely felt a sense of obligation to react to what had happened to us in 9/11. I definitely felt that we had a very good reason for going into Afghanistan and being there. So that was a strong reason for me to go ahead and sign up and serve. For me, also, it's somewhat of a family tradition. My mother was in the military. My grandfather served in the Army also. So it was a combination of patriotism and a sense of obligation, definitely.
And you've certainly done what was expected of you as a coming from a military family, right?
Yeah.
Do you get that feeling of payback in a fight, in a real shooting war like that?
Well, it's a little more complex than that, and once you get there and all the glitter wears off and you're confronted with the reality of a war, it's definitely not. Well, it's a little bit of a different situation, but I still have a sense of accomplishment, and I think I feel very very content about going over there and doing what we did. And if it's asked for me in the future, I will definitely go ahead and do so.
Staff Sergeant Joe Sturm, I'm wondering, you know, a lot of soldiers complained earlier that all the attention was on Iraq and Afghanistan was not being covered by the media. I'm wondering, in recent months, has your opinion changed? Do you think we're giving enough attention to the war in Afghanistan now?
Well, I think that, you know, during the bloodiest years of the Iraq War, 2004 through 2006, it probably was the front page story. Afghanistan, at least during the period that I was there, 2004 and 2005, was, relatively quiet, and I think Iraq was given its due attention. But, you know, now we're seeing casualties mount daily in Afghanistan. We're seeing, you know, two or three guys killed a day. I mean, we had eight killed in Nuristan province over the weekend. So Afghanistan's definitely front page news now, but I never personally felt like we were forgotten. You know, Afghanistan has been labeled as the new forgotten war, and that never bothered me at all.
So, Genevieve, Staff Sergeant Genevieve Chase, you had a very close call. What happened when you were riding in the contractor's truck in 2006?
We were returning back from a routine meeting within Lashkargah, and we were attacked by a suicide vehicle-borne IED just outside of the gate before we entered into our provincial reconstruction team area.
And was anyone killed? Injuries?
No, we all survived that attack. We were all in an up-armored Ford truck, and because of the level of armor on that vehicle, we all walked away from it.
But it must still rattle you.
Absolutely. It was a significant explosion. The car that hit us disintegrated. In fact, it wasn't until the next day that I actually believed everybody else when they told me that it was a car that had run into us rather than an IED that we had ran over. So it took my having to actually see what little remnants there were of the Toyota Corolla in order for me to believe that we had been hit by a vehicle.
Toyota Corolla, a tin can of a car. Well, Genevieve, tell me a story of your time in Afghanistan which conveys, I think Americans 8 years into this war, many of them who don't have the sort of firsthand knowledge as you do, wonder how can you judge that the commitment has been appropriate and that this war is in any sense winnable? Is there a story you can tell about your time there that says to me that this is doable, this is winnable, this mission is coherent and clear?
I think something that really needs to be taken into consideration is the fact that, our presence there allows for so many things. And although we did try to build, civil affairs projects and build schools and infrastructure probably a little bit prematurely, we underestimated the tenacity with which Afghans fight, and we shouldn't have, because there's a long history there that would have indicated that we hadn't won anything at any point. But looking at the children of Afghanistan and watching little girls go to school with their counterparts, with their brothers and their cousins, their male cousins, and then watching women become a little bit more proactive, both in their government and within their communities, in seeing a change in, you know, where years ago they were stoned in the street, and now they're put in women's prisons in a lot of locations. Being able to see some of those changes are fascinating, and they're also encouraging. But at the same time, I think a lot of the people in the American public don't get to see a lot of that stuff happening. And so when we talk about drawing down the troops or not sending in more troops, and yet we still are screaming outrage at the way that women and children are treated in Afghanistan, it kind of, the two arguments don't really go really well together. So we have to really consider both.
Sergeant Joe Sturm, from being on the ground, why is it so difficult to make progress? 8 years on we're talking about not really having made a lot of progress. Why is that so? What makes it so hard?
Well, I think that it sort of goes back to the idea that you never truly know who the enemy is. I think that Afghanistan, of course, we've heard for all these years that, you know, the border with Pakistan is very porous, and that's absolutely true. You can go into a village on a humanitarian assistance operation and give the kids clothes and shoes and warm coats and medical care, and, you know, make friends with the village elders, drink tea, and everything's fine that day. And then that night, you know, the Taliban or whomever will come down out of the mountains and, you know, burn the school down and beat up the elders and take away everything that the Americans have given them. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really Afghanistan is a very schizophrenic place.
It's hard to make progress there. Staff Sergeant Joe Sturm is now with the Department of Veterans Affairs. Staff Sergeant Genevieve Chase was a veteran of Afghanistan. We are also joined by Specialist Marco Reininger, who is a specialist in the National Guard.
All served in Afghanistan. 8-year war today.
Hey, you want that to go?
Some quick takeouts now on stories that we're following this week.
We're going to begin with the Todd Zwillick, Takeaways Washington correspondent. So, Todd, yesterday on this program, you said that lawmakers were very interested in hearing what Obama, the president, had to say about Afghanistan policy in meetings that took place yesterday. What did the lawmakers hear, and what was their reaction when you spoke to them?
Yeah, well, we got a little grain of news coming out from the conclave there in the White House. About 30 members met with the president. Caught up with Congressman Jack Murtha, a powerful Democrat from Pennsylvania, after the meeting. Here's what he had to say.
I think he said, this is not get out or add 40,000 troops.
Right.
I think it's something in between, and he didn't, no indication at all how he's going to decide or when he's going to decide.
Jack Murtha controls the Defense Appropriations Committee. You got to delve into what he said there. The president told him it's not get out or add 40,000, not either or. The president meaning he's not going to pull troops out of Afghanistan, reassuring members that he's not going to do that. So that's the message that Jack Murtha brought out of that meeting.
Is it possible that he's signaling, though, that a reduction is possible in some way, which seems like a headline to me?
Well, according to Murtha, the president seems, you know, John, there were not off the record conversations, background
Don't
conversations.
Don't get yourself in trouble. Don't get
I won't. That the president is not discussing cuts, but maybe discussing increases that are a lot smaller than what the generals are suggesting. We'll have to see what he decides.
Right. And who else did you talk to?
Well, one of the interesting things going into this meeting, as you know, John, we've talked about it, is this notion that the president is dithering on this on this discussion about Afghanistan, and something the White House and members and Democrats really wanted to knock down. Listen to the Speaker of the House and the Majority Leader coming out of the White House yesterday.
The meeting was good. It was thorough. Everyone participated. And the president was very resolute.
The president made his statement, which was a very strong one, about how deliberative the process would be about making a decision.
Now, that's Pelosi and Reid. Was it bipartisan, the reaction at all?
Not so much, but those words are really interesting. Thorough, resolute, and deliberative, all the dictionary opposites of dithering.
Dithering.
So they came out with a message. The president is the commander-in-chief, and he's making a decision. He's not dithering in the White House. They wanted to knock that one down quick.
All right, no dithering on Afghanistan. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks, Todd.
Next to Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. And Louise, this seems odds. One of the things that people are doing during these tough and economic times is they're buying prepaid debit cards. Why are they doing that?
Well, it seems like it might be safer than credit cards. In fact, the slogan on one of these visas is safer than cash. But it turns out it's way more expensive than cash. It's really kind of a ripoff. Listen to this one. There's one called the McCash Prepaid MasterCard. Here are the fees. $9.95 activation fee, $1.75 ATM fee, 50 cents for every purchase, $4 every month. Oh, and if you don't use it for 60 days, $2 inactivity fee. So these are kind of a false assurance.
That's the highest interest rate I've ever heard of on a card.
Yes.
And a lot of the people who are purchasing these prepaid cards are of lower income. What are the higher income people doing with their money?
Well, something we saw yesterday is that gold futures shot up to $1,045 per ounce. That's highest it's ever been. We've been on this run-up in gold. And I got to tell you, there's people out there who are buying gold because they don't believe in the dollar anymore. They're nervous about it. I know someone who had a birthday a few weeks ago who was given a few $1,000 in gold, and she's going to just hide it around her house. I can't tell you who she is because I don't want you to go to her house.
Right, right.
but they're nervous. People
what about
nervous.
These rumors yesterday that Saudi Arabia was maybe doing its oil transactions outside of dollars, which rattled the dollar? Any truth to that?
Well, for weeks, we've been seeing countries saying they may not use the dollar as their reserve currency. The leader of Brazil came out recently and said he'd like it if the BRIC nations could make their own reserve currency, that they'd work together and trade in. And so if you see nations moving to some other currency than the dollar, it is going to devalue the dollar. And remember, part of what's going on here is we've got massive U.S. debt. Our market debt is more than $6 trillion now. And that's making regular people nervous and investors nervous and people, you know, who can scatter gold around their house nervous.
Is that a smart move? Is that what people, you know, is that a good idea to start collecting Krugerrands and hiding them in your potted plants?
Well, gold is a universal currency, and it's been recognized for thousands of years, right? But and I think it may be a little safer than these prepaid cards.
Right. And cheaper.
Well, which the Treasury is going to need soon enough with that debt that you were describing.
The prepaid cards,
yeah,
for
exactly.
Treasury.
Right. Louise Story is our finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times.
Final takeout comes from Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor. So the Minnesota Twins triumphed last night. They romp over to Yankee Stadium for what may or may not be a drubbing in the first game in the American League. But the National League gets underway in the playoffs today as well, right?
The National League is exciting tonight. Last night, the Minnesota Twins won 6-5 in 12 innings. We're not going to have that kind of elite baseball for a long time, because what you see is the Rockies and the Phillies and the Cardinals versus the Dodgers. Both of those teams, all of those teams have been kind of sitting. They've been kind of waiting for these other games to wrap up. They're a little cold. You're not going to get the level of baseball that the Minnesota Twins and the Detroit Tigers have been playing for the past week and a half.
So it's going to take a couple of games for these National League series to get really down to earth and to be playing good infield baseball, good defense, that sort of thing.
Exactly. And I think I had a rubric that dealt with starting pitching, the bullpen, clutch hitting, power hitting, and small ball, which are some indicators to determine who's going to do good or not. But you can whittle them down to two things. The bullpen, who pitches good in the 6th, 7th, 8th, and 9th innings. That's really what determines playoff baseball, as well as the wild card, because the wild card creates momentum. And right now, in this instance, the Rockies have the momentum over the Phillies. And then the Cardinals and Dodgers is a really even match, because they both limped into the playoffs. So that's going to be a really interesting series.
In the National League, and then we're going to go to the WNBA here in a second. In the National League, who has the edge in the later innings in terms of pitching, do you think?
The Dodgers have the best bullpen in the National League. And in terms of starting pitching, the St. Louis Cardinals have the best starting pitching.
A lot of people want the Dodgers with Joe Torre to come marching back to Yankee Stadium and have a World Series between the Dodgers and the Yankees. Do you?
It would be a great, great story, and I would love to see it.
Which is probably why it won't happen. Exactly. All right, so the WNBA Finals are going on. We could close it out tonight, right?
The Indiana Fever are at home, and they're up 2-1 against the Phoenix Mercury. They can win their first championship tonight. It's a game 4. They're at home. They can make it happen. Both teams came in. The Phoenix offense is ranked number 1, and Indiana's defense is ranked number 1. So this is a great matchup of two great teams.
Who play very different styles of ball, and it's really not necessarily a favored Phoenix.
Phoenix's style is to like slash in the paint and then bounce the ball back to Diana Taurasi, who is the league's MVP. She'll knock down big, huge three-pointers. The problem is that in the finals, she hasn't been making the big open shots.
And that's been the difference. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor, thanks so much. Those are your takeouts. Coming up, the Taliban has set up shadow governments to the Afghan government officials in most provinces. They even have their own diplomats, undermining the government. More on their influence in just a few minutes. Coming up on the 8th anniversary of the U.S. war in Afghanistan, the Taliban is commemorating that anniversary. We'll find out why from the BBC's Martin Patience. He's going to join us from Kabul in just a moment. Right now, let's check in on top news stories at 33 minutes after the hour. Healthcare overhaul is still on hold in the Senate Finance Committee. Senators are waiting for a final number crunch to assess the cost of the bill before voting.
The Supreme Court hears a church and state case today. It hears arguments about a large cross at a memorial in a California public park. And today, President Obama meets with his national security team to talk about strategy in Afghanistan. He's weighing a request for a major troop increase there. Those are some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
So 8 years after the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan, this is the message from the Taliban, and it's being heard almost everywhere across Afghanistan. He joined us earlier today from Kabul, the BBC's Martin Patience. He's the Afghanistan correspondent for our partner, the BBC, and we asked him what we were listening to there on that Taliban tape.
Well, this is a message. It's not clear when it was recorded. It could have been recorded a year ago. And basically it's saying, it's a Taliban militant saying that if you want justice, then you have to come to the Taliban. Forget about the government and its corrupt employees. It's only the Taliban that can offer justice to the Afghan people. So it's a very simple message, but it's one that is gaining currency
across
the country.
8 years into the war, we want to assess the state of the Taliban. Robert Gates, the Secretary of Defense, said as recently as this weekend that the Taliban appears to have the momentum in Afghanistan right now. Also with us is Christine Fair, a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Good morning, Christine.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And continuing with us is Specialist Marco Reininger, an Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America spokesperson who is a specialist in the National Guard and has served in Afghanistan as recently as 6 months ago. And you're expecting to return there, right, Marco?
That's correct, John.
Assess for me the quality of the propaganda coming out of the Taliban in your experience.
Well, unfortunately, the Taliban is very tech-savvy, and they have entire propaganda factories in the Pakistani tribal areas that, aside from bootlegging Hollywood movies, they also distribute and produce pretty technologically advanced propaganda in form of videos and things of that nature. So,
and part of the message, Martin Patience, is that the Taliban is in control, that there's a shadow government in place, and that the people of Afghanistan should, in a sense, be loyal to the Taliban government. What have you learned?
Yes, that's right. I think what the Taliban are saying, that if you want justice, you need to come to us. And what was seen in recent years, particularly in the south and the east of the country where the insurgency is at its strongest, is that the Taliban are setting up these shadow governments. Now, the reason they're doing that is twofold. One, they want to win the hearts and minds of the people. It's very easy to forget that the Taliban, too, they have a strategy as well as the American strategy. And what we're seeing is that it's increasingly successful. Many Afghans are turning not to the Afghan government for justice, but the Taliban themselves. And that's because they don't need to deal with corrupt officials. So, in effect, the Taliban in many parts of this country is replacing the authority of the Afghan government.
Well, indeed, the Taliban have their own diplomats. Here's Abibullah Fauzi, who's a former Taliban ambassador to Saudi Arabia, making an argument of why the Taliban has more credibility civically in Afghanistan than the government of Afghanistan itself.
You see that our people is poor people. They have a lot of problems. All of them need justice. They will help those people who give him the justice, and the justice will not come with the corruption.
Christine Fair, professor at Georgetown University, does the Taliban have a good argument when they try to make this shadow government case?
Well, of course they do, and I think we need to remember that that's how the Taliban came into power in the first instance. They came in, they cleaned up the corruption that was really characterizing the conflict waged by the different Mujahideen commanders. They were also very effective in saving young children from basically the Mujahideen had kept young boys as catamites. And so the Taliban really came in on a wave of providing security and justice. And I think one of the biggest travesties of the last 8 years of international effort to rebuild Afghanistan is that it's been so heavily focused on the Afghan National Security Forces that there's been absolutely no attention paid to supporting ministries such as the Ministry of Interior, completely riven with corruption, deeply involved in various illicit trafficking, and obviously one of which is narcotics, but also gems, timber, etc. Ministry of Justice, you have at the district level a completely dysfunctional judiciary system. So training police without a full system of rule of law basically mean that you've trained security guards.
So, Marco Reininger, you're a specialist, and you have to deal with this. Does what Christine Fair is saying there, corruption in the Afghan government, does it make your job more difficult, more dangerous, and you're less able to convince the Afghan people to cooperate with American troops and NATO forces?
Well, absolutely. I mean, not only does it affect security for us and our Afghan counterparts, but it just undermines every effort that we're trying to achieve over there in terms of, well, the popular phrase is to win the hearts and minds. If you can't trust the people that are meant to protect you, then it's very difficult. And we've seen everything from police officers being involved in extortion, kidnapping, and things of that nature. So it's just really hard to convince the Afghan people that we're really there helping them.
Well, Marco, you make me—I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it suggests that if what you're saying is true, then no amount of increased U.S. troops is going to fight that corruption argument that the Taliban has in its favor.
Well, what I think we really need to do is tackle that root cause, which is corrupt officials inside the system. So I think we shouldn't be scared to removing these people. Of course, you know, it's difficult because sometimes it happens at a very, very high level. And it's just the nature of the beast.
Martin Patience, do you see any sense that NATO troops can erode this sense of corruption on the part of the Afghan people for their own government?
Well, ultimately, it's not up to the NATO troops. It's up to the UN and the international community. But the larger point is this. Any counterinsurgency strategy is only as good as the government you support. And the big problem that the American military has out here is that it's supporting an Afghan government which, in many people's eyes, particularly many Afghans, isn't legitimate. And until you resolve that issue of how do you reform the Afghan government, it's going to be very difficult for the American military to pull off any success.
Martin Patience, BBC Kabul correspondent. I can give you 10 seconds, Christine Fair. Final thought?
It actually isn't even in the hands of the international community and the United Nations. It's actually in the hands of, right now, the Kabul government.
Right.
And the last 8 years demonstrates that Karzai is either unwilling or uninterested in providing clean governance.
That's Christine Fair, professor of Georgetown University, and Marco Reininger on his way back to Afghanistan. Thanks so much. And the question there really sort of poses the challenge for U.S. forces and NATO forces. Creating credibility for the Afghan government is really what it's all about.
Yeah, the takeaway for me is how do these soldiers fight a war and win hearts and minds when they're fighting for a government which is corrupt?
Do you have any thoughts on that? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. The war in Afghanistan is 8 years old today. Is it a war of necessity? We're going to talk with Richard Haass of the Council on Foreign Relations in just a few minutes. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. Today, Attorney General Eric Holder and Education Secretary Arne Duncan are going to be going to Chicago to talk with the Mayor Daley there to talk about the levels of youth violence in the Windy City. Last week, many people already know the story. There was a video that was taken from a cell phone that put the Chicago public system into a very harsh spotlight. It captured dozens of teenagers in a brawl, and an innocent bystander, Darian Albert, was brutally beaten to death there. In fact, five teenagers have been killed during this school year. That's five teenagers murdered in less than a month. At least 47 school-age kids in Chicago have been killed in homicides, mostly gun homicides, since the month that Barack Obama took office in January. So, what is going on in the Chicago area? Why is youth violence so high, and what can be done about it? Joining us is Linda Lutton. She's the education reporter with WBEZ Chicago Public Radio. Good morning, Linda.
Good morning, Celeste.
So many people have already watched this video either on TV news or even on YouTube. What happened to Darian Albert?
Right. It was playing almost constantly. I guess what we know from my own reporting and some other reporting that's come out, Darian was walking home from school, walking to a bus stop, and there are two sort of feuding groups at Fenger High School, where he attended school, and those two groups started to brawl. Some people have classified him as an innocent bystander, others have qualified that a little bit and said, well, it looks like he threw a punch too, or if he didn't want to be in that fight, he wouldn't have wandered in there. In any case, we do know he was a very good student at Fenger High School, and any way you cut it, a big tragedy for the city, but part of an ongoing story of youth violence here. It's not an isolated incident.
There is a new chief officer of the public schools, Ron Huberman, and he has a very interesting solution to this problem. A former cop, he has worked up this method by which to calculate the risk that every student in the district has of being shot. Is that right?
Yeah. That's right. It's one reporter here called it a newfangled probability model. It really is. It's essentially they took all the kids who'd been shot, all CPS students who'd been shot over the last 5 years, and looked for common characteristics. They said, what do we know about these kids? And it turned out that they tended to be male, black. They tended to miss a lot of school. They tended to be in special education. And based on that, Huberman said, let's figure out who is most likely to be affected by gun violence. And he
but
has,
it turns out that, that
has
that,
a list of 200 kids. He says he knows where they live. He knows who they are.
Right, but Albert would not have been on that list. So
he
this other
have.
Solution that he has is the safe passage solution where he's basically going to bust them through trouble areas, right?
Right. Before school started and before we had these initial these killings, certainly before Darian Albert, Huberman unveiled at the beginning of the school year a very bold plan to address youth violence. It's something that's plagued the city and that the city's been very in tune with the last couple years. That plan involves three pillars. One of them is targeting these kids most likely to be victims of violence. The other involves safe passage. Let's get kids. He said he's willing to bus kids, even if it's just a few blocks, across gang lines.
He has changed bus routes safely.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
Linda Lutton is the education reporter for WBEZ in Chicago. Thank you.
I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, the question, is the war in Afghanistan a war of necessity or a war of choice? Richard Haass will answer that question in just a moment. But we're also asking you about the war in Afghanistan. And for many of you, there is no choice.
My name is Melissa Felina. My brother is 29 years old. He's been in the U.S. Marine Corps for 6 years. He decided to get out for a year and a half, and then he re-upped in the Army. He is now in Afghanistan, and it's a really, really emotional subject. But it's your own brother, but, you know, I really believe only they only choose the best for this. You know, all you can do is leave it in God's hands, but Obama really needs to make up his mind what he's going to do because it's very, very hard on their family.
Call us with your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can email us to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Right now, we're checking on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. The Senate Finance Committee is waiting to learn the full price tag of its health care plan. The committee won't vote on its bill until a new cost breakdown is in from the Congressional Budget Office. A newly passed Senate bill bars Guantanamo detainees from transfer to America. Attorney General Eric Holder doesn't like the move. He wants Gitmo closed and prisoners tried in the United States.
Two Americans and an Israeli are the latest winners of the Nobel Prize in Chemistry. Their work on cells led to new drugs to fight infections. And looking ahead, President Obama continues deliberations on U.S. strategy in Afghanistan and Pakistan today. He'll meet with his national security team this afternoon. He told lawmakers yesterday he won't sharply reduce troops in Afghanistan. That's a look at some of the stories we're following this morning.
So we're going to round out our discussion on Afghanistan we've been having all hour with Richard Haass. He's the president of the Council on Foreign Relations and author of the book War of Necessity, War or Choice. And at the time of the invasion of Afghanistan 8 years ago today, he was an advisor to Colin Powell, who was then Secretary of State. Richard Haass, good morning. And let's take a listen to what George Bush was saying exactly 8 years ago today.
More than 2 weeks ago, I gave Taliban leaders a series of clear and specific demands. Close terrorist training camps. Hand over leaders of the Al-Qaeda network and return all foreign nationals, including American citizens, unjustly detained in your country. None of these demands were met. And now, the Taliban will pay a price.
And that price was the Afghan War, which turns 8 years old today. Richard Haass, was the Afghan War at the time the president spoke 8 years ago, in your view, a war of necessity?
It was a war of necessity, John. The United States at the time was exercising its right of self-defense. The Taliban had harbored and facilitated the Al-Qaeda attack that was September 11th. Also at the time, people may not remember this, but we were very worried about follow-on attacks. There was no way of knowing then that September 11th was essentially a one-off. So we believed we had no choice but to act quickly to oust the Taliban once it was clear they were not going to meet U.S. demands.
In your view, when did that change, this idea of Afghanistan as a war of necessity to address a real threat to Americans?
Well, I believe it morphed into what I would describe as a war of choice over the next few years, and it's been a gradual process rather than, if you will, a switch. And something becomes a war of choice when your interests become less than vital and when you have a range of policy options or alternatives to the use of military force. And by the time we had a friendly government in Afghanistan that was no longer working with the Taliban, I thought that essentially marked an important transition in that country's situation. And we obviously have a full range of options. there's the question of how many combat forces we have there and what they do, but there's also everything else we might do, from training to diplomacy to using dollars to affect the behavior of what Taliban are back inside the country. So the situation has changed fundamentally today as compared to 8 years ago.
Richard, when this war initially began, we heard a lot about al-Qaeda and the Taliban's support for al-Qaeda. Now, when we talk about the war, the president says we will pursue the Taliban as far as we need to pursue, and there's not a lot of mention of al-Qaeda anymore. And I'm wondering, does the Taliban still have those strong connections with al-Qaeda? Is the Taliban still a clear and present danger to us here in the United States?
That's a great question, because a lot of people, Celeste, assume that there's almost no difference between the Taliban and al-Qaeda, and I simply don't assume that. First of all, the al-Qaeda are essentially out of Afghanistan. They've set up shop in neighboring Pakistan. That's also where a lot of the Taliban are. There are, however, Taliban back in Afghanistan. But it's not clear to me that even if the Taliban were to, say, regain a lot of control in Afghanistan, and that's a big if, I don't take it as axiomatic that they would reestablish the same relationship with the Taliban that they had eight or 10 years ago. Indeed, one of the options for American foreign policy is to try to drive something of a wedge between at least some of the Taliban and al-Qaeda, and I wouldn't rule that out.
Let's take a look at one of the other premises of this war that I think the administration has talked a lot about, and that is denying a safe haven to al-Qaeda and groups like it in Afghanistan. First of all, the safe haven premise would suggest that we would need to intervene in places like Congo and Somalia and Sudan, other places which could theoretically be a safe haven for groups like al-Qaeda, and that a doctrine of denying safe havens could be a pretty open-ended bargain.
You've got it exactly right. There's nothing special or unique about Afghan real estate when it comes to al-Qaeda's ability to operate. So unless the United States is essentially going to occupy a good chunk of the world where governments are unable or unwilling to deny al-Qaeda real estate, I simply don't think that's a serious approach to foreign policy. The other argument you hear is not simply that Afghanistan is central to al-Qaeda, which again, I don't believe is true, but that it's central to Pakistan. But there again, I think there's an open question, because it's not obvious to me that the Taliban or al-Qaeda need a sanctuary in Afghanistan to threaten Pakistan when they've essentially established a sanctuary within Pakistan itself. So I think the fundamental arguments that seem to be driving the Afghan debate are somewhat suspect.
Now, the drawdown in Iraq is going to be coupled with apparently some sort of increase in Afghanistan. Is that to say, then, that the mission, if, as you say, the al-Qaeda issue is relatively moot inside Afghanistan, is that to say that all this is really about is face-saving, essentially the old Vietnam scenario where we save face, we pull out so it doesn't look like we're retreating?
I think that's too strong. There are interests in Afghanistan. I do think, even if it's not vital, the United States has a stake in, say, not allowing al-Qaeda to operate with impunity out of Afghanistan or anywhere else if we can prevent it. It's possible that people based in Afghanistan could make the situation in Pakistan worse than it already is. We've got a human rights set of concerns to think about, because if the Taliban were to come back completely in power, it would obviously create an awful lot of misery. There is the prestige argument that you just alluded to. So I don't think you can say the United States has no interest in Afghanistan. It's simply that I would suggest they don't rise to the level of vital national interest. So to put another way, we've got to scale the level of our investment in the country in a way that's commensurate with the level of our interest.
All right, let's do the math then. Richard Haass, President of the Council on Foreign Relations, what is an intervention in Afghanistan that would be commensurate with the actual interests there? Is it at the size of the DMV between North and South Korea, or something smaller, like, say, you know, the troops in Okinawa?
I would say it's probably larger than both at the moment, but the most of what I would have those troops doing is training both the central police and army forces of Afghanistan, but also I would expand dramatically the training of local forces. Afghanistan has a culture and a tradition of decentralization, and whether you call them regional authorities or governors or warlords, the fact is that Kabul has never really run the country. So one of the things I would look like, and it's actually very similar to what we did with tribesmen in Iraq, is look for ways to train up local authorities who could help keep the peace and keep groups like the Taliban or certainly al-Qaeda at bay.
So finally, how many more years do you have in Afghanistan, do you think, based on the signals you're getting from the Obama administration?
Oh, I think we have quite a few years to come, but I don't think that's the issue. The real question is more the how much it costs us, the casualty rates and so forth. So I believe the American people would support a long-term investment in Afghanistan so long as there was a ceiling on that investment and it seemed to things seemed to be improving. And if that's the case, the Obama administration has quite a few years. You just mentioned places like the DMZ in Korea. History suggests the United States can stay places for quite a long time so long as casualties and costs are limited and things seem to be moving in the right direction.
Richard Haass, thank you. The president of the Council on Foreign Relations. He's also the author of War of Necessity, War of Choice. And at the time of the invasion of Afghanistan, he was an advisor to Colin Powell, who was then Secretary of State. Thank you.
So what do you think? After 8 years of a war in Afghanistan, is it one of choice or is it a one of necessity? We want you to weigh in on the debate. And how does it appear in your life if it does at all?
This is Amy Parker from Berkeley, Michigan. My daughter, America Parker, was born September 24th, 2001. Her name is America, and we've been at war her whole life.
What are the signs of war in your life, and how do you think it's changed maybe your attitude toward the war since it started 8 years ago? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway. Thanks for listening to the Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.